Chapter 6 of Walter Youngquist's book, Geodestinies. Title of this chapter, Mineral Riches and How They Are Spent. Eons to Form. The mineral resources we're using today were formed during geologic ages past, some as long as 2 or 3 billion years. The coal deposits in Pennsylvania and West Virginia that were the original energy basis of the steel industry in that region are more than 250 million years old. The relatively young coals of Wyoming are 60 to 80 million years old. The banded iron deposits of Minnesota, called taconite, took several million years to be deposited, well over a billion years ago. Then, by the process of geologic uplift, fracturing, and subsequent eons of weathering, some of these deposits were further enriched to form the high-grade iron deposits called hematite. These deposits remained in the earth for more millions of years before being mined. In the case of oil, untold myriad organisms, along with algae, lived and died and sank into an anaerobic, devoid of oxygen, watery environment to be slowly buried with accumulating sediment. Ultimately, when buried to sufficient depth and with the proper increase in temperature, some of these deposits became oil that had to further migrate into reservoir rocks, which in some cases were arched or pierced by salt domes or faulted to form traps for oil. Economic oil deposits result from long and complex geologic processes that in only a few places form very large deposits. The Persian Gulf is the best example. Used in an instant. Fossil fuels and minerals are the great heritage of geological events upon which we now build and maintain our civilization. But in a relatively geological fraction of a second, these resources are being consumed. Soon these gifts from the past, in the case of mineral energy resources, petroleum, coal, and uranium, will be gone forever. Some metals can be reclaimed and recycled. Still, there is an inevitable percentage that will be dissipated and can never be recovered. How some wealth has been preserved. One of the interesting and important aspects of the discovery and development of mineral deposits are the ways in which individuals, communities, and nations have spent this great one-time wealth. Although the resources are consumed mostly by the generations that discover and develop them, there is an argument that at least some of these riches should be passed on in some form to future generations who did not have the good fortune of living during this period of great mineral wealth. These are your children and your children's children. To be sure, some of this wealth will be there in the future in the form of buildings, factories, houses, roads, bridges, railroads, locks, canals, power stations, water lines, sewers, and many other structures for which mineral resources and the wealth derived from them are used. But in the case of fossil fuels, although they help to construct these features of civilization, their use leaves no legacy when used to power motor vehicles, except negative legacy in terms of climate change. That was an editorial edit there. The same is true with other energy uses, such as space heating and in producing products with a limited life, such as automobiles, airplanes, household appliances, and sporting goods. Some of these products can be recycled, but inevitably much will be discarded. Thus, the legacy is mixed, because in some cases the resource will be of lasting benefit to people and to regions, but in other instances, it may literally mean that more people suffer hardships in the long run as populations expand, enabled by and dependent upon a resource base that will eventually be depleted. Individuals and their wealth. Although it is the miner or the oil wildcatter who discovers the valuable resource, they are not necessarily the ones who make the largest profit. Frequently, it is the developer or entrepreneur who reaps the greatest rewards. Miners come and go, but the general store and the storekeeper sell the potatoes, flowers, nails, and shovels remain. It has been said that those who mined the miners were the ones who got rich. Leland Stafford, gold. Leland Stafford supplied the California 49ers with their mining and household needs. The miners are lost to history, but Leland Stafford survives as the founder of a great university that he named the Leland Stafford Junior University, still the legal name, in honor of his son. The gold of the Sierra Nevada has largely been mined out, but its legacy, through Stanford University, in the form of educated minds, is the most important resource of all. A nation can benefit greatly from the discovery of mineral resources long after that resource is gone. Levi's. An interesting sidelight to the California Gold Rush is the origin of the now famous blue jeans called Levi's. Levi Strauss was a poor immigrant in New York. He made tents out of canvas material. His brother went to California during the Gold Rush and enthusiastically wrote back to Levi that there was a great demand for tents for the miners. But by the time Levi arrived in California, the demand for tents had fallen off. Instead, there was a great need for durable work pants, which could also be made from heavy tent-like material, denim, with which Levi worked. Levi Strauss set up his factory in San Francisco that still supplies Levi's to the world, a legacy, in a sense, from the California Gold Rush. John D. Rockefeller. It is reported that when they sang the doxology, students attending chapel at the University of Chicago would sing, "Praise John from whom all blessings flow." This was because John D. Rockefeller, with his oil money, founded the University of Chicago. Years later, from a laboratory underneath the stadium, the atomic bomb that ended World War II was invented at a University of Chicago laboratory. Rockefeller became the object of much hostility because of his single-minded development of the great oil monopoly, which became the Standard Oil Company. In 1911, it was broken into many parts by antitrust legislation. But even before he had any wealth, Rockefeller was a generous person. During the first year he worked, he made frequent small contributions to charities, missions, and Sunday schools. Later, as his wealth grew from his oil interests, his gifts became very large. During his lifetime, he donated $530 million to various causes. And this was when $1 million was worth much more than today. The equivalent would easily be more than $5 billion today. Rockefeller funded the Rockefeller Sanitary Commission, later incorporated into the Rockefeller Foundation to promote worldwide health. Its research determined that the hookworm disease could be eliminated. It also conducts research on tuberculosis, yellow fever, pellagra, malaria, and various viruses. The foundation continues to make numerous grants to medical schools, not to increase their number, but to improve their quality. One of Rockefeller's lesser-known grants was to Spelman College, a school founded in Atlanta in 1881, which was then and still is devoted to the education of African-American women. The school, also known as the Atlanta Baptist Female Seminary, when the grant was made, was renamed Spelman in honor of the abolitionist parents of Rockefeller's wife, Laura Spelman Rockefeller. Other gifts from the Rockefeller oil legacy included land given to help create Acadia National Park. In 1901, Harvard University President Charles Eliot and George Dorr organized a board of trustees to acquire as much land as possible in the scenic Bar Harbor, Maine area, and to set it aside for public use. The surprising single largest bequest was 11,000 acres given by John D. Rockefeller, nearly a third of Acadia, that was incorporated into the U.S. National Park System in 1919 by President Theodore Roosevelt. More than 40 million people visit the area each year. Rockefeller money also purchased the land for the site of the United Nations in New York. Rockefeller funds established Rockefeller University, which focuses on the causes and cures of diseases, population studies, and related disciplines. Land donated for the site for the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, land contributed for the establishment of the Jackson Hole Preserve in Wyoming to preserve the primitive grandeur of the area, 33,000 acres of land for national parks in the Grand Tetons, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and parks in New York State were all Rockefeller gifts. Rockefeller oil money was among the major contributions made to the New York Zoological Society, Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts, the United Negro College Fund, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Rockefeller money restored Williamsburg, the capital of colonial Virginia, visited annually by more than 1 million people. Altogether, Rockefeller founded or was a major contributor to 47 philanthropies. Most, if not all, will survive even beyond the entire period of the World Petroleum Interval. Over the course of their existence, these philanthropies will have touched millions of people who never heard of Rockefeller and his oil company. his family has carried on the tradition of giving. His son, John D. Rockefeller Jr., gave $10 million to the New York Metropolitan Museum of Art, $1 million to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and $5 million to the United Negro College Fund. Henry Flagler. Henry Flagler, Rockefeller's partner in Standard Oil, is not nearly so well known. He used his oil money to develop Florida, pushing a railroad all the way through the state to Key West, and building hotels along the way. He also brought huge tracts of land and lured people to Florida, both to live and as tourists. Oil money helped put Florida on the map. Wallace Pratt, oil. One of the survivors of the breakup of the Rockefeller oil interests was the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey. A Kansas farm boy, Wallace Pratt, a geologist educated at the University of Kansas, ultimately rose to become the director of the company. As a geologist, Pratt was fascinated by part of West Texas where great Permian coal reef structures are clearly exposed. One example is a distinctive promontory named El Capitan. Pratt purchased a ranch there and upon his death willed the ranch to become the basis for what is now Guadalupe Mountains National Park. At the park headquarters, his legacy is properly noted. Andrew Carnegie, iron ore. Carnegie built the U.S. Steel Corporation, capitalizing on its high-grade iron mines in Minnesota and Michigan. He became a multimillionaire by the age of 40. Andrew was born in a poor weaver's cottage in Scotland in 1835. By the age of 12, he was the family breadwinner, and he and his family emigrated to the United States, where he became a telegraph operator at the age of 17. By savings and making careful investments, he eventually owned his own business and ultimately got into the steel industry. In 1873, he built the first fully modern steel mill. The country was growing rapidly, and steel was in great demand, especially for railroads. Carnegie made a fortune. At one time, he was the richest man in the world. Always remembering the poverty of his past, Carnegie said that, quote, "It would be a disgrace to die rich." However, he did not simply give money away. In fact, he was contemptuous of almsgiving. Instead, he gave money, as he said, to assist, but rarely or never to do it all. He preferred to donate money to build, as he said, quote, "ladders upon which the aspiring can rise," unquote. In many small towns all across America today, there remain solidly built Carnegie libraries. He gave a library building to nearly every community that offered a site for it and would agree to maintain the building. Eventually, his fortune built 2,500 libraries in Eastern-speaking countries. $40 million went to erect 1,679 libraries in the United States alone. These libraries originated from the iron ore deposits of the Upper Great Lakes region. True, these libraries are small, and for the sake of economy, most of them are of only one design, now classic. In many communities, this was the first, and for many years, the only library for miles around. Who knows how many youngsters got their first introduction to science and literature in these places, and how many went on to distinguishing careers which grew from this seed. Many of them continue to be places where students in relatively remote areas have access to a library that they wouldn't have otherwise. In the state of Oregon, Carnegie built 32 libraries, of which 16 are still in use in such places as Union, an isolated community of fewer than 2,000 people in the Blue Mountains of Central Oregon. Without the Carnegie money, there would probably be no library there. But Carnegie donated one in 1912, where it has remained in service ever since. In 1908, the small community of Petoskey on the eastern shore of Lake Michigan received a Carnegie grant of $25,000 to erect a library that continued to be used for that purpose until 2004. The community of less than 7,000 then built a new library. Over these intervening 96 years, the Carnegie Library undoubtedly opened new worlds to many children and adults in the community. The Carnegie Foundation of New York was established for the promotion of the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. The foundation is one of the major supporters of the public broadcasting system and was an underwriter of the award-winning educational children's program Sesame Street. Untold numbers of children who had never heard of the man who made his money from iron ore have benefited from his generosity. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace is another legacy from iron ore. In a variety of ways, this fund seeks to promote world peace. Given the current state of world events, it could hardly be more relevant and timely. The Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh, the Carnegie Institutes in Pittsburgh and New York, and Carnegie Hall in New York are examples of Carnegie's idea of ladders, quote-unquote, upon which people can rise to greater things. Carnegie also generously gave to Cooper Union in New York, established as an evening school to train engineers. Later, it expanded into daytime operations. Because it is endowed by Carnegie and other donors, it charges no tuition. The Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, based in Princeton, New Jersey, recently announced a comprehensive plan to revamp elementary education and made $1.5 million in grants to 13 schools across the United States to embark on this project. Carnegie gave generously to black schools, including Hampton and Tuskegee, which promoted industrial arts and character building. He also established an interesting endowment named the Carnegie Hero Fund, which annually rewards medals and financial grants to persons who exhibit outstanding acts of bravery on behalf of their fellow citizens. Carnegie also gave money to the Pratt Institute, established as a coeducational school for, quote, practical training, unquote. These are prominent examples of what American iron ore did for society at large. The high-grade iron ore that made these things possible is now depleted, but the legacy lives on. This iron ore legacy even reached the old world. Andrew Carnegie was a loyal Scot and eventually retired to Scotland, where, among other things, he set up the Carnegie Trust for Universities of Scotland. Carnegie's first library grant was to his birthplace, Dunfermline, Scotland. In total, Carnegie gave away more than $350 million at a time when the dollar brought much more than it does now. Although he died without being as poor as he started, the money he left at his death was given to various causes which he designated. His children inherited none of his money because Carnegie believed that people should earn their way in life. Carnegie could be a generous Scot because of geological processes that took place more than a billion years ago in the upper Great Lakes region of the United States. This geological circumstance of long ago affected the lives of many thousands, perhaps millions of people. A remarkable geodestiny. Cecil Rhodes, Gold. A Rhodes Scholarship is one of the highest honors and most valuable awards a student can receive. By means of this fund, some of our most distinguished leaders have obtained their higher educations. These scholarships were established by Cecil Rhodes, who founded the British South American Company to rework old gold mining areas in what ultimately became known as Northern and Southern Rhodesia, now Zambia and Zimbabwe. These regions were probably the richest gold fields of the ancient world. The gold was discovered in an area 500 miles long and 400 miles wide. The mines had long produced large quantities of gold, but so much gold remained that about 90% of the approximately 130,000 newly registered claims were staked on the sites of old workings. Rhodes, through his British South African Company, brought in miners and other settlers in the 1890s. By 1905, this area was once again a world-class gold producer. Rhodes made a modest fortune from his gold mining interests. In his will, he provided enough money for about 200 scholarships for a term of 3 years each on a perpetual basis. The British South African Company went out of business in 1923 after the gold deposits were depleted. However, the intellectual legacy from the gold will survive as long as Rhodes scholarships exist. Guggenheim, gold, silver, copper, diamonds. The Guggenheim family made their several individual fortunes from the silver of the Leadville, Colorado area, gold in the Yukon, copper in Alaska, Utah, and Montana, and diamonds in Africa, among other mineral resources. Branches of this family set up a number of foundations and made a variety of charitable contributions, including $12 million to the Mayo Clinic and $22 million to Mount Sinai Hospital. Guggenheim money established a number of art museums in the United States, as well as in Germany, Italy, and Spain. The most famous of these foundations is one set up by Simon Guggenheim in 1924 in memory of his late son. The John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation sponsors Guggenheim Fellowships that are awarded to artists, scholars in the liberal arts, and to scientists. More than 10,000 individuals have benefited from this endowment that gives encouragement, particularly to promising young talents. One beneficiary was the late Linus Pauling, who often gave credit to his Guggenheim Fellowship for helping him out at an important time in his life. Pauling later won 2 Nobel Prizes in chemistry and peace, the only person ever to do so. Hearst Publications, Silver and Gold. The Hearst publishing empire is yet another legacy that originated in mineral wealth. A substantial part of the Hearst family millions was built on the silver-rich Comstock Lode discovered in 1859 at the present site of Virginia City, Nevada. It was here that George Hearst of San Francisco made his first fortune. He did the same thing again in the South Dakota gold strike of 1877. With this money, he established the Hearst publishing empire. The remarkable Hearst Castle, now a state park open to visitors on the California coast, is another result of mining wealth. Many other legacies from mining wealth. Carnegie, Guggenheim, Hearst, Rhodes, Rockefeller, and Stanford stand out as individuals who left large cultural monuments. Additional thousands of people whose identities have been lost to history also have built lasting monuments through their collective contributions. Mining and oil boom towns soon brought families with the desire for something besides saloons for cultural centers. The now famous San Francisco Opera came to San Francisco as a result of the gold rush. The Alaska gold rush also brought opera briefly to that northern land, but it did not last. It is a rare university or college in the United States and Canada that has not received money, equipment, or scholarships from a mining or oil company. With an endowment of more than $3 billion, chiefly derived from oil revenues on state lands, the University of Texas is the world's richest educational institution. To fill its fine campus buildings, the university used its money to hire outstanding faculty. With oil revenues now declining and the endowment no longer growing as it once did, the institution is being challenged to see if it can maintain itself as it did in the more opulent oil-supported past. The fund trustees are well aware that oil is a one-time benefit and are working to invest its money wisely for the long term. The province of Alberta. Oil. Although minor oil fields such as the Turner Valley Field existed in the 1920s and 1930s, the first major discovery of oil in Alberta was Leduc No. 1, discovered shortly after World War II. This precipitated a rush of oil and gas exploration, and the cities of Edmonton and Calgary greatly expanded. The Calgary Philharmonic, now one of the premier orchestras of Canada, is housed in a beautiful facility paid for largely through the prosperity that oil brought. An examination of the back of any Calgary Philharmonic Orchestra program, where benefactors are listed, is the quick way to find out which oil companies have offices in Calgary. Almost all of them do. In Canada, with very few exceptions, all mineral resources belong to the government, the Crown. Alberta has rich oil and gas fields, which have made Alberta by far the richest province in Canada. Other provinces are far behind in growth and per capita income. Alberta also has the lowest corporate taxes in Canada, which help attract population and industry. It has a rainy day fund of $2.5 billion, Canadian dollars. Alberta is the only debt-free province in Canada, and over the past several years has had annual income surpluses. Alberta has enjoyed prosperity considerably among that of the other provinces, considerably beyond that of the other provinces. With the oil revenues, it established the Alberta Heritage Fund, from which bequests are made each year to a variety of cultural and artistic organizations. The fund also provides various financial advantages to Alberta residents with respect to taxes and loans. Presumably, if carefully managed, this fund will survive long after oil. In 2005, flush with royalty income and taxes from the high price of oil and natural gas, and from the increased production of oil in the Athabasca oil sands, the Alberta government sent a $400 check to every resident of the province. Alberta, and especially the oil capital of Calgary, of Canada, Calgary, are the fastest growing province and city in Canada. The province is the envy of the rest of Canada, which, through various legislative means, has tried from time to time to seize some of Alberta's resource wealth. It is a continuing battle between Alberta and the central government in Ottawa. Even dinosaurs benefit. In 1985, Alberta opened a magnificent structure to house some of its most spectacular ancient residents. In the scenic badland topography of the northwestern edge of the old coal mining town of Drumheller, about 70 miles from both Calgary and Edmonton, stands the world-class Terrell Museum of Paleontology. There is no better paleontology museum anywhere, and the star attractions, the dinosaurs, are wonderfully well displayed. Responding to a question about the funding for this facility, the museum's director, Dr. Emlyn H. Koster, put it this way, quote, "As one of the more costly cultural facilities of the Alberta government, the Terrell Museum capital project coincided with an affluent early part of this decade due to a very buoyant oil and gas industry," unquote. It was money very well spent and is worth a visit. Alaska. This has become the richest state in the Union on a per capita basis due to its small population and the presence of the largest oil field in the United States. However, because it is so dependent on the fluctuating prices of oil, Alaska has seen some brief depressing times. At present, Alaska is rich, but North Slope oil is being depleted. Since the 1967 discovery of oil on the North Slope, chiefly the Prudhoe Bay field, as well as other small fields nearby, the state of Alaska has received more than $40 billion in taxes and royalties from oil to date. How have these monies been spent or invested? With the completion of the Alaska pipeline, oil and money from the Prudhoe Bay began to flow in quantity. Strohmeyer, in his 1993 book, describes what happened then, quote, "The state did not know what to do with the gusher of money that poured in after oil began to flow from Prudhoe Bay in 1977. Alaskans had expected the royalties would ease the lean state budget and flesh out capital expenditure, but even the most optimistic projections did not foresee the world events that would send oil prices into orbit. By 1981, oil had reached a high of $34 a barrel, an increase of more than 1,000% in 13 years. As owner of the Prudhoe Bay oil fields, the state collected about 12% royalties from the sale of every barrel piped to Valdez. During the Iranian crisis alone, Alaska's revenue tripled to $500 million. Unquote. Alaska increased its state spending 20-fold. As a result, Alaska currently has the lowest personal tax burden and highest per capita state government spending in the United States. With the new wealth, a number of state programs were set up, including a loan subsidy program for farmers growing barley, which resulted in $70 million of unpaid loans. As an interesting footnote, it was reported that, quote, "Many of the farmers who were taking money from the state to grow barley were double-dipping, simultaneously taking money from the federal government to not grow barley," unquote. Jesus. Several hundred million dollars were also lost in loans to other economically doubtful enterprises, including a venture to produce a dog-powered washing machine. A performing arts center in Anchorage costs $70 million to build and loses $1 million a year. High school students have been sent on European field trips. An oil royalty trust fund, the Alaska Permanent Fund, was set up in 1976 and now has investments totaling $27 billion. In 1982, Alaskans voted to give themselves an annual dividend from the fund, which takes most of its earnings. That year, each Alaskan man, woman, and child received a $1,000 dividend check. A University of Alaska report says that the state is now spending about $1.2 billion more than it can afford in the years ahead. It has been calculated that if Alaska had increased its spending at just the average rate of the other states over the past 25 years and earned a very attainable 5.15% on its excess oil income, it would have had a $75 billion fund at the end of 1993. This would have earned it about $1 billion more in annual interest than Alaska spent in 1993. Thus, Alaska appears to have missed the opportunity to enjoy permanent financial security. Alaska's citizens have demanded the annual dividend payment in spite of the declining revenues from the Prudhoe Bay field. The record payout was $1,964 to each person in the year 2000, and in 2002, the dividend was $1,541. In 2004, the dividend was $1,860 per person. As oil production inevitably declines, the oil dividend will dwindle, and Alaskans will have to go back to depending entirely on whatever current income their non-oil economy can produce. Previously, this was chiefly marine products, crabs, and fish. Many Alaskans want to delay that eventuality by drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and building a natural gas pipeline south from Prudhoe Bay. It is hard to wean citizens off this oil welfare and make them think of the future. The present generation of Alaskans is living off its oil inheritance in several ways. Alaska has no sales tax, no income tax, and the lowest property taxes in the United States. A survey of the 50 states by Kiplinger's Personal Finance magazine in August of 1995 reported that for a retired couple with a $50,000 a year income, living in a 2,000-square-foot house, the annual tax burden in Alaska would be $253. The highest tax burden among the states was in oil-less Wisconsin at $9,528. Oil makes a huge difference. No other oil fields the size of the approximately 12-billion-barrel Prudhoe Bay field are expected to be discovered in Alaska. About 60 miles to the east of Prudhoe Bay, the geology suggests that perhaps a field or fields not as large as Prudhoe Bay might exist in a small portion of the coastal plains of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The idea of developing it has split Alaskans and other Americans over its environmental effects, such as its possible impact on the 125,000-strong porcupine caribou herd and the wilderness solitude that reigns north of the Brooks Range. Alaska's oil revenues are certain to decline in the long run, to the point where there will be little or no such income. If future generations of Alaskans are to be considered, then the abundant but transient oil revenues of today must be used differently. The political process has allowed this generation of Alaskans to capture benefits at the expense of future generations by plundering much of the wealth of its non-renewable oil resource. Of the initial 12 billion barrels of oil reserves in the Prudhoe Bay field, 7 billion have been produced, that is, extracted. Production has peaked and is now declining. Estimates are that even if new oil fields are put into production on the North Slope, sometime within the next 10 years, oil production from that region will fall to only half of what it currently is. The economic impact this will have, given Alaska's current spending habits, will be severe. Countries. Mineral wealth not only funds institutions and endows states and provinces, it has transformed entire countries. However, the use that oil-rich countries have made of their wealth is a very mixed bag. Pope, in his 1996 book, commented, quote, "If oil wealth is like winning the lottery, nations act like lottery winners. They tend to blow the money," unquote. Some do and some don't. Examples of both follow. Indonesia. This archipelago is the fourth most populous nation in the world, with 240 million people. Until 2009, it was a member of OPEC. Its oil deposits were developed by Shell Oil Company, which began as a trading partner that actually dealt in part in seashells when Indonesia was a Dutch colony. This is how the Shell companies got their start, and they retained the Shell symbol. Indonesia was the prize that the Japanese needed to keep the war machine going, and they occupied it for a time during World War II. After the war, Indonesia gained independence from the Netherlands and continued to be an oil exporter. It has now become a net oil importer, with domestic oil demand now exceeding production. During the early post-war period, a virtual dictatorship ran the country, and there is no visible evidence of where its oil revenues went. Under the present government, all oil revenues support the daily economy. Saudi Arabia, petroleum. The discovery of oil dramatically changed Saudi Arabia and the life of its citizens. In part, this was already covered in Chapter 5, but additional information is included here. Saudi Arabia's enormous oil wealth presented some formidable investment challenges. Before oil was discovered, the country's economy was mostly simple local oasis agriculture, some fishing and pearl diving in the Persian Gulf, and nomadic herding of sheep and camels. Additional income was generated by Muslim pilgrims visiting Mecca. In 1932, the Saud family united the various tribes of the Arabian Peninsula into the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. As recently as 1940, the port city of Jeddah was a walled city of about 50,000 inhabitants. Jeddah today is a thoroughly modern city with plazas decorated with sculptures, high-rise apartments, wide boulevards, and one of the tallest buildings in the Middle East, the 44-story National Commerce Bank. At one time during its development, there were 355 ships waiting to unload cargo at Saudi ports. As recently as 1962, there was only one radio station in all of Saudi Arabia. The first railroad did not reach the capital until 1951. In 1950, there were no paved roads in Saudi Arabia, but by 1982, there were more than 7,000 miles of main highways and more than 6,000 miles of paved secondary roads. More than 15,000 miles of earth-surfaced rural roads were built to some 7,000 villages, which, for the most part, had never seen a road previously. The international airport at Jeddah, constructed at a cost of $4 billion, covers more than 40 square miles, is 50% larger than Kennedy, LaGuardia, O'Hare, and Los Angeles airports combined. Oh my God! It is capable of receiving as many as 100 aircraft an hour. There are four grades of terminals, the most lavish of which is the Royal Pavilion, designed for the royal family. It has a copper roof, white marble walls, and its main reception hall has the Thai silk wallpaper and gold embroidered tapestries. Adjacent is the ultra-modern press room with complete radio and television equipment. The airport at Jeddah was soon overshadowed by the airport built 22 miles north of the capital. This facility is more than twice covering an area of 94 square miles. In 1978, there were only about 125,000 telephones in Saudi Arabia. By 1985, just 7 years later, there were more than 1 million phones in operation, serviced by equipment supplied by major communications companies in the Netherlands, Sweden, and Canada. Saudi Arabia today has the most advanced computerized telephone exchange system of any country in the world. Because the entire system was so recently built, there is no old obsolete equipment in service. As part of its communication system, Saudi Arabia has a domestic satellite system of 11 mobile and 3 fixed earth stations, which allow anyone with a telephone anywhere in the kingdom to dial directly to anywhere in the world. For a villager who 40 years ago had no roads, no lights, no sewer, no telephone available anywhere in his village, and spent the day herding sheep or camels, this is quite a change. Schools through the university level and hospitals were built. The Saudis spent vast sums of money to speedily bring themselves into the 20th century and beyond. Although inefficiencies are inherent in such a mammoth and rapid undertaking, much of the oil money has been employed wisely. The Saudis know that even the world's largest oil field reserves are finite. However, some of the money has been spent supporting a growing number of Saudi princes in lavish lifestyles, a source of increasing discontent in the general population that may spell future trouble. Along with the production of oil and the development of large shipping facilities for the resource, Saudi Arabia realized that rather than being just a raw material supplier for foreign markets, it should process more of its petroleum, oil and gas, into added value finished products. To do this, Saudi Arabia has developed and is expanding a large petrochemical complex located in the newly established cities of Jebel and Yanbu. The cost is about $45 billion, and the project uses the technical talents of more than 40,000 people from 39 countries. These facilities may ultimately rival those for which the Houston, Texas area has long been known. The inevitable shift in emphasis from being a raw material producer to upgrading the resource to the finished petrochemical end products will have a large economic impact on other such facilities around the world. Saudi Arabia has the oil and gas reserves to support these plants for many decades, at least long after the reserves of the United States and the North Sea, Britain and Norway, have been exhausted. Losing the capability to produce raw energy materials or metals is much more important to a domestic economy than the simple percentage the raw material represents in the gross national product. This point is largely unrecognized by politicians, economists, and the public at large in the United States, where there has not been a lot of support for the oil and mining industries. Indeed, these enterprises, fundamental to the economic well-being of the country, have been treated rather unkindly at times. But in the meantime, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and other oil and gas producers are putting up refineries and petrochemical plants in their lands. Some metal producers are also doing the same thing by building plants to upgrade their raw materials before shipment abroad. Chile is smelting copper ore, and Venezuela is using its gas to set up aluminum smelting facilities for its own ore and that of neighboring Suriname. Water was a limiting factor in the economic life of Saudi Arabia, but petroleum came to the rescue here too. Using the abundant natural gas supplies produced along with the oil, the Saudis developed desalinization plants that now produce more than a billion gallons of fresh water a day from the sea, by far the largest such enterprise in the world. Electric power is generated using waste heat from these and other facilities, all based on petroleum. The story of the electrification of Saudi Arabia is perhaps the most spectacular of all. The first public electric generating plant was opened in Taif in the late 1940s. Since then, nearly the entire country has been electrified, and all major buildings are now air-conditioned. So Saudi Arabia went from nomadic tents in the desert to air-conditioned multi-story office buildings in less than 50 years. There has probably been no greater transformation of a country of any size anywhere in the world than Saudi Arabia. Without petroleum, the entire region would have remained simply an obscure, arid land. One of the interesting items that oil brought to Saudi Arabia is a 60-ton solid granite bathtub. In 1983, King Fahd ended his worldwide hunt for the perfect bathtub in a granite quarry in Manitoba, Canada. A flawless piece of granite was cut, hauled to Montreal, then shipped to Italy, where some of the world's finest stoneworkers sculpted and polished it, including giving it the final touch, the crest of the royal family carved on the tub. It was then shipped to Riyadh, the capital, and installed in the palace. Another positive result of the Saudi oil bonanza has been the training of Saudi young people. At one time, virtually any male, women were generally excluded then, who could qualify academically could study abroad at government expense in almost any subject he wished. Educated people will be the country's ultimate greatest asset, paid for by petroleum. Regardless of problems that have arisen from the sudden great wealth of oil money for Saudi Arabia, the country has energetically transformed itself into a thoroughly modern nation to the immense benefit of its citizens. Probably no other government or country has done so much to spread the benefits of the oil wealth to all of its people. In some relatively oil-rich countries, the oil wealth seems to disappear, quote-unquote, before it shows up in projects and services for the general public. But in Saudi Arabia, the benefit of the oil riches are more widely evident. Kuwait. Oil. On a smaller but similarly impressive scale, the story of Saudi Arabia has been repeated in Kuwait. Kuwait is a very small nation located at the northwestern end of Persian Gulf. It was a British protectorate until 1961 when it was given full independence. Prior to the discovery of oil, Kuwait was an insignificant land of sand whose principal exports, such as existed, were skins, wool, and some pearls. The discovery of oil changed all that. With an area of 6,880 square miles, Kuwait is smaller than some counties in the United States. For example, Harney County, Oregon, has an area of 10,166 square miles. Yet its proved oil reserves, already discovered, are larger than the reserves of the entire United States, including Alaska, with a total area of 3.5 million square miles. The discovery and development of oil has meant free education for all Kuwaiti citizens as far as they want to go. It means no income taxes, subsidized housing and utilities, free medical care, and a government grant of more than $7,000 to every couple upon their marriage. The country has its own airline, Kuwait Airways, which flies Boeing 747s on regularly scheduled service from New York and London to Kuwait. The Kuwait government and private interests share ownership in Mobile Telecommunications Company, which now has 110,000 mobile telephone subscribers and 150,000 pagers. Among numerous minor facilities built by the Kuwait government is an Olympic-sized ice skating rink, a novel luxury in this hot, dry land. To develop Kuwait as rapidly as it has, a large number of workers were imported. At the peak of activity, 75% of its workers were foreigners. They outnumbered the Kuwaitis. There is obviously an internal threat inherent in this situation, but it has merit also because when times are slow economically and for security reasons, the country can simply decree that foreign workers return to their homelands. Recently, this is what they have done. After the first Gulf War, the number of foreigners in Kuwait was greatly reduced. Nearly all the Palestinians, for example, were forced to leave. Although the current Kuwait population is estimated to be 3 million, less than 1 million are Kuwait citizens. The rest are foreign workers. With this small number of people sharing the income from some of the largest oil reserves in the world, the standard of living is very high. Understandably, Kuwait makes it difficult for anyone to become a Kuwait citizen. Rich as it is today, Kuwait has a keen eye on the future. Since gaining independence, Kuwait has invested its large oil reserves in a great variety of assets, including $2 billion in the most respected stocks listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Kuwait has also established the Kuwait Reserve Fund for future generations. This organization and the Kuwait Petroleum Corporation bought 14% of the West German carmaker Daimler-Benz, 20% of the German mining complex Metallgalstoff, and about a quarter of the giant German chemical company Hoechst. Perhaps taking the saying "there will always be an England" to heart, even after oil, Kuwait bought 5.1% of British Midland Bank and also invested heavily in English real estate. They own a 1 million square foot complex of restaurants, shops, and offices along the Thames in London, and about 9% of British Petroleum Corporation, BP. Kuwait has invested more than $2 million in Madrid, Spain, and is looking at other possible investments in Australia, Singapore, Malaysia, and Hong Kong. In the United States, Kuwait purchased Santa Fe International, a California-based drilling company, and it also has a large portfolio of United States real estate, including 100% ownership of the Kawa Island Resort in South Carolina. It owns several New York skyscrapers, but have kept this hidden in deference to the Jewish tenants of some of these buildings. In order to assure a good market for its oil, Kuwait bought most of the European marketing and refining operations of the former Gulf Oil Corporation, and they are adding to the system by building more gasoline stations of their own. The Kuwaitis have a brand of gasoline they market as Q8 that is distributed through more than 4,700 retail stations in a number of countries, including Italy, Denmark, Sweden, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg. Kuwait earns more money, about $7 billion annually, from these enterprises than from its sale of oil. Once the oil is gone, Kuwaitis hope and believe that these investments will continue to allow them to pursue a reasonably affluent lifestyle. Clearly, Kuwait is very conscious of the finite nature of its oil riches and has been working hard and quite successfully to put itself in a position to survive beyond petroleum. A Kuwait government economist states, quote, "Our investments will be the main source of income for generations after the oil runs out," unquote. In late 1989, Kuwait announced it was drawing up plans for multi-billion dollar petrochemical and petroleum refining industries to upgrade its end product rather than just shipping out raw crude oil. By 1995, this program was well established. Of the 2 million barrels of oil produced today, 1.2 million was exported as crude. Of the other 800,000 barrels, part was refined and shipped as finished product, and part was further upgraded to petrochemical specialty products by Kuwait's Petroleum Industries Company. The gas is used to promote or to produce fertilizer. Kuwait continues to expand its petrochemical operations. Since the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq, Kuwait is even more conscious of the great wealth it holds and the need to carefully preserve it in some fashion for future generations. The first Gulf War temporarily modified some of Kuwait's financial plans. The true cost of the war to Kuwait was that it used most of the cash it had accumulated, approximately $20 billion, for further investments. Kuwait also spent $11.7 billion on military equipment, including 200 U.S.-made tanks, 40 fighter planes, and 200 British armored personnel carriers, a regrettable tribute to the instability of the Gulf region. Since the first Gulf War, Kuwait has spent about $12 billion for arms. Its financial reserves before the war were $100 billion. War costs greatly reduced this, but they've now been built back to more than $50 billion, and they currently generate a budget surplus of about $3 billion a year. Mostly, however, Kuwait has figuratively spent its oil money on butter, not guns. In view of the vital interests that the Western nations have in protecting Kuwait's oil, as demonstrated by the first Gulf War, Kuwait's emphasis in using its oil money for long-term investments seems a wise course. Along with not using most of its money for armaments, another encouraging trend is that Kuwait's natural population increase has been reduced from 2.7% in 1990 to 1.9% in 2007. Duncan and Youngquist, 1999, projected an oil production peak at 4.6 million barrels a day in 2018 and a 38% decline in production by 2040. Projected population growth and oil production figures are on a collision course, so it's good that Kuwait made extensive investments elsewhere for the future. However, it may be that Kuwait will not admit so many foreign workers in the future and decide to make more investments at home involving its own citizens. Militarily, as long as a modest amount of oil production exists, the West will look after Kuwait. Bahrain. Oil was discovered in 1932, one of the first in the Persian Gulf, but oil production is in decline. Recognizing the problem early, the government of Bahrain built a huge aluminum smelter that uses the energy from Bahrain's gas deposits, which are a long-term reserve, which are a longer-term reserve than its oil. The large number of oil tankers and other vessels related to the development of the Persian Gulf region made Bahrain's island location an ideal place at which to build large dry dock facilities. Bahrain's location was also strategic for an offshore international banking center. This was developed and has thrived. Also thriving are the recently introduced Western-style entertainment attractions, facilitated by relaxation of some of the strict social rules of the adjacent Muslim states. The 22-mile causeway to Bahrain from the mainland allows for easy access to Bahrain's attractions. United Arab Emirates, oil. Dubai of the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, in six-page ads in American business magazines, quotes Sultan Ahmed bin Sulayem saying, quote, "We knew the oil boom would not last forever, and that a more stable and diversified source of capital was required," unquote. Dubai's answer has been to create what they call the Hong Kong of the Middle East. This is a mammoth free trade zone, which first required 2,500-acre harbor to be dug at the edge of the desert. Around it, on 25,000 acres, they built an industrial and warehouse complex. They hope that their location at the lower end of the Gulf gives them a geographic advantage, making them the trans-shipper of goods from the Middle East into Africa and Asia. The free trade zone imposes no inconvenient tariffs and offers a number of other financial advantages. Also, Dubai has a first-class airport, its own international airline, four hospitals, and a golf course. a $14 million cricket and hockey stadium, tennis and squash courts, and a bowling green have been built. They also advertise that beyond golf, tennis, and the like, tourists can watch camel racing from a special viewing building. They further note that, quote, one-time popular pastime pursued in Dubai is found nowhere else in the world, is wadi bashing. Its rules are deceptively simple. It involves nothing more elaborate than driving in wadis, which are dry riverbeds that flow from the Hajar Mountains into the desert, or on the east coast toward the sea. So far, this free trade zone project seems to have been a success. Dubai is the most rapid and amazing development in the Gulf region. A sudden city has appeared on the desert sands. Where less than 20 years ago there were donkey carts on unpaved roads, there is now an eight-lane paved highway. They built the world's largest mall, the Mall of the Emirates, with 2.4 million square feet, including an indoor ski jump and mountains, quote-unquote, with snow where children throw snowballs at each other. It is patronized by the entire world. Direct oil revenues now account for only about 6% of Dubai's income. Skyscrapers with businesses, condominiums, and hotels fringe the waterfront and extend inward, making corridors for increasing traffic. A striking structure of Dubai's development is the Burj Al Arab, a high-rise luxury hotel built on a man-made island off the beach at Dubai, designed to resemble the sails of an Arabian dhow, D-H-O-W, I don't know what that is. Built out of the shallow gulf, there is a palm tree formed by dredging. The palm tree has quotes around it, with palm fronds carrying houses, a structure visible from space. Dubai has become the commercial center of the Gulf, a vacation spot and, for some, the new home for wealthy Europeans. Nothing like this change in the desert has ever been seen, and in such a short time. Indeed, Dubai is a sudden city. Along with its useful developments, however, in 1995, the UAE began to spend money on armaments. They embarked on a large military purchase program, which included the purchase of 12 ship-based helicopters at a cost of about $350 million. The UAE also negotiated contracts for the purchase of up to 80 long-strike warplanes, patrol aircraft, helicopters, and frigates. It is questionable how effective this small country can defend itself in a major military engagement, even with this new equipment. The two faces of Dubai. All this transformation has come at a cost. Behind the skyscrapers is a world of fleabag hotels and prostitutes, Indian and Russian mobsters, money launderers, and smugglers of everything from guns to human beings. More than half of Dubai's population lives on foreign workers' camps. Asian workers sleep in dormitories that open on to standing sewage. Dubai has only modest reserves, but their new economy is still dependent on oil, especially from the adjacent oil-rich countries, and also a world economy based on oil. Will desert sands eventually reclaim the paved streets and abandoned skyscrapers by the end of the 21st century? Or will Dubai survive on some other economic basis not now foreseen? In the meantime, Dubai presents two faces of the so-called miracle in the desert. Oman, oil. This is the only nation in the Gulf region where the rulers bear the title of Sultan, which indicates a Muslim sovereign combining political and religious authority. The present Sultan came to power in 1970. Oman began commercial oil production in 1967. Oil production peaked in the first decade of this century and is expected to drop 84% by 2040. With this in mind, the country's emphasis has been on diversifying the economy as quickly as possible by developing agriculture, fishing, and tourism. Oman has also seen a large shift in population from rural to urban areas and is experiencing a severe housing shortage. Providing the infrastructure of electric utilities, water, and sewer in these increasingly dense populated urban areas is a priority and has taken a great deal of money. Oman, like the other Persian Gulf countries, has also spent its oil money to buy military equipment. In view of the fact that its present population of 3.1 million is expected to increase to 5.3 million by 2050, it may be that armament money could be better spent developing the country's infrastructure. Iraq. This nation has tremendous oil resources, much of which remain undeveloped. Otherwise, Iraq is a rather poor country. Its population has grown to the point where much of its food must be imported. Yet under Saddam Hussein, Iraq spent huge amounts of money on weapons, which were first used in a futile 8-year war with Iran. The total cost of the conflict came to about $500 billion. Much of this money was used to buy massive amounts of military hardware, which at the time of the first Gulf War included 4,000 tanks and 2,500 heavy artillery pieces. Using Iraq's diminishing oil income to finance failed military adventures will go down in history as one of the greatest mistakes ever made by a national leader, and a tragedy for his people. After the invasion chiefly by U.S. forces in 2003 and their departure in 2011, the future of Iraq is unsettled. It will take a great deal of work to establish a sustainable political and economic footing in which oil income can pay for the increasing food imports needed for the rapidly growing population. Hopefully, in the new Iraq that will emerge, big spending for weapons like Saddam Hussein's did in the past, and the oil income can be used for constructive purposes to benefit all Iraqis. And editor's note, as of January 2016, ISIS is a whole new phenomenon there that obviously Youngquist couldn't have factored in, because this was written before that. Iran. This country also used its oil wealth to buy military equipment. Initially, it was the Shah of Iran, 1941 to 1979, who began the military buildup because he was determined to make Iran the dominant nation in the Gulf. He also wanted to defend Iran from its longtime enemy, Iraq. He bought so many planes and tanks that it was estimated at one time there were 3 planes for every qualified Iranian pilot. Iran's military buildup continued after the Shah's overthrow with Iraq. Eventually, war with Iraq broke out. During its 8-year span, Iran used virtually all of its oil income for military expenses. Nothing was put in place for the future. Now that the Iraq war is over, perhaps its substantial oil income will be used for domestic developments. Although Iran passed its peak oil production in 1973, it produces 6 million barrels a day and still has the second largest oil reserves in the world. Its gas reserves are huge, estimated to be 940 trillion cubic feet. This is even larger than the gas reserves of Qatar. Both Iran and Qatar share the huge geological structural dome containing gas, which lies across the lower portion of the Gulf. Iran appears to have a slightly larger share of that structure. With the rising worldwide demand for natural gas, Iran stands to greatly benefit from its huge gas reserves. It already ships gas abroad in the form of liquefied natural gas, LNG. Iran, however, continues to spend considerable oil income on armaments. It has obtained 2 submarines and will get a 3rd. It also purchased 5 Chinese-made patrol boats, which can be armed with missiles, and has obtained surface-to-air and surface-to-surface missile systems. These armaments have been placed at the mouth of the Persian Gulf, the strategic Strait of Hormuz, through which 50% of the world's oil flows. Using its oil and gas revenues to purchase more armaments seems unfortunate, since Iran has the most diversified economy in the Gulf region. Properly nurtured, a diverse economy can sustain the country well beyond the petroleum era. Additional money to develop its water and agricultural resources would be a wise investment. Iran has spectacular mountain scenery, and its tourist industry has excellent potential. Investments in tourism could yield a high return, as well as provide employment. The economy, however, is not producing enough jobs to employ its slowly rising population. Unemployment is about 30%. And 40% of its citizens live below the poverty line. The Iranian clerics control considerable oil income, leading to unrest in the younger population. Although the continuing development of the South Pars gas field, as well as the higher oil and gas prices, are, well, not as of this reading in 2016, are helping to maintain petroleum income, the best days of Iran's Iranian petroleum are past. Trying to advance its economy and provide social welfare needs related related to housing and unemployment can absorb all the oil income that may be generated in the future. Like many other countries, including the United States, military spending diverts money that could be used for better purposes. Among the Gulf nations, Iran has by far the longest and most distinguished history. Its archaeological sites are numerous and varied, and many are well preserved. Iran has contributed in many ways to both science and literature and has been a leader in the region in culture and education. To a considerable degree, Iran still maintains that position. In contrast to the other countries, women in Iran were given the right to vote in 1963. Iran has potential for a good future. It will continue to have oil income for a considerable time, allowing it to make the transition to a post-petroleum economy. Oil income spent on military hardware will not be useful to that end. Libya, oil. Libya is yet another example of the initially very poor nation catapulted into the 20th century by oil and by oil alone. Libya has an area of about 680,000 square miles, about one-fourth the size of the 48 adjacent United States. Arable land is a very small part, and most of it is desert. Without its oil, Libya would still be living on the fringes of the world economy, remaining mainly a country of nomads and small farms. At the time oil was discovered in 1950, Libya's population was about 2 million. With only a narrow strip along the coast suitable for conventional agriculture, the land in an agricultural economy could not support many more people. Libya's impact on the world economy prior to the discovery of oil was slight indeed. But now it has oil reserves from production of about 1.4 million barrels a day, and its population has tripled to about 6.4 million. Libya has a mixed record for spending its oil wealth. Early after the discovery of oil, under the leadership of the wise old desert chieftain, King Idris, it spent money on roads, sewers, wells, and other generally useful public enterprises. But when King Idris traveled to Greece for medical attention, a colonel named Gaddafi led a coup to depose Idris and seized power. Government spending soon shifted from civilian projects to military hardware. Gaddafi brought ground equipment for 20 tank battalions, modern missiles, trucks, and artillery mostly from the Soviet Union. For his air force, French Mirage fighters were produced. Six ex-Soviet submarines and numerous small surface craft made up the Libyan Navy. In 1989, Libya was found to have built a chemical weapons plant. Some public works were continued, but planning became haphazard. In part of a major road system where cloverleaf interchanges were built, the project was less than well thought out. In several places, it was necessary to make a U-turn against oncoming traffic in order to get on another road. Funded by oil revenues, Libya engaged in exporting terrorism and invaded neighboring Chad to the south. Its terrorist adventures were discouraged by a U.S. Air Force bombing attack and by the presence of the U.S. Navy off the Libyan coast, which led to the shooting down of several Libyan fighter planes and the sinking of torpedo boats. French military forces were dispatched to Chad, helped defeat the Libyan invasion. That inland country was officially part of France's African Empire until 1960. However, Libya has made a few constructive investments to keep it going beyond the time of oil. These include a one-half interest in an oil refinery in Hamburg, Germany. Libya also owns a small airline, Libya Arab Airlines. What may or may not turn out to be a good investment is the grandiose scheme to pipe water from deep below the sands of the Sahara to the coastal areas. Colonel Gaddafi stated that his $25 billion Great Man-Made River project would convert the country, which is now 95% desert, into, quote, a Garden of Eden, unquote. The plan called for 12,500 miles of pipeline to carry water to all areas of the coast. However, as the wells were drilled in a desert area where there is no appreciable recharge, it is likely that any water there has accumulated over a long period of time. Heavy pumping from the aquifer will far exceed the recharge and water levels will drop. There is, in fact, geologic evidence to indicate that the water is what is sometimes called fossil water, water preserved from the geologic past that cannot be duplicated again. The water must make a 9-day, 750-kilometer trip through a pipe 4 meters in diameter. Expectations are that it will make the desert bloom and new lands will be opened for rapidly increasing Libyan population. With considerable flourish, Colonel Gaddafi opened the valve of the initial stage of the project. Unfortunately, thanks to a minor engineering error, nothing happened. No water. It was a bit embarrassing, but was later corrected. Just as money spent on the current military will eventually be of little or no value, this project is likely to have a limited life. Contrary to the expectations of Gaddafi, rather than being a monument to great thinking, it is likely to become a monument to folly. Groundwater sparingly used in isolated Libyan oases could last for many thousands of years for the scattered peoples of the desert. But with the proposed heavy pumping, it will be a short-lived resource. It will provide only the illusion of a sustainable future. Expanding the economy and population based on that illusion will come to grief. It is sadly apparent that tanks, guns, planes, and secondhand Soviet submarines will be a large part of the legacy Libyans inherited from their once affluent oil era. Production peaked in 1969 at about 3 million barrels a day and is now down to 1.4 million barrels a day. Gaddafi later appeared to have had a change of attitude. He acknowledged spending substantial sums to obtain materials to build an atomic bomb. He agreed to give up all the materials for the bomb he had purchased. What a small country like Libya would want to do with an atomic bomb is unfathomable, except perhaps for terrorism. This is a classic example of money wasted in a country urgently in need of improved infrastructure, better roads, educational and health facilities, and a sound economic base to survive beyond oil. With the uprising of 2011 and the violent end of Gaddafi's rule, hopefully the country's future oil income can be put to constructive purposes for the benefit of all Libyans. Oil buys arms. Military spending by oil-rich countries, principally in the Middle East, has overshadowed all other investments. In the 12 years following the first Arab oil embargo in 1973, with the subsequent huge rise in oil prices and concurrent huge increase in revenues for oil producers, the Gulf nations spent more than $640 billion for military purposes. Iraq and Iran spent billions, which served only to finance an 8-year war of attrition ending in stalemate. An estimated 1 million people were killed, and many more were wounded. Without the oil money to finance the advanced weapons of war, it is probable that at least the casualty figures would have been less. What a tragic way to waste forever the proceeds from a non-renewable resource. Oil has been a mixed blessing to many countries. In 2007, the Persian Gulf countries spent another $20 billion for arms. Now these countries have the latest state-of-the-art weaponry, including all sorts of missiles, tanks, jet fighters, helicopters, warships, and other hardware. But there is a question whether or not these nations are safer or happier with all these devices of destruction. Arms shows in the Middle East have become regular events. It is big business. The judgment of history on the way in which some of the temporary oil riches are being spent is likely to be severe. Mexico. Oil. Mexico is another nation that geology destined to have rich mineral resources. Initially, this may have actually been a curse. It lured the Spaniards looking for gold and silver, who plundered and ultimately destroyed much of the native civilizations, and brought smallpox and other diseases which further decimated many communities. More recently, black gold, oil, has become Mexico's most important mineral resource. Oil was discovered quite early in Mexico, but only in modest quantities. What was probably the world's largest oil-producing oil well was drilled in Mexico, producing some 2 to 3 million barrels of oil a day for a time. It wasn't until the second half of the 20th century that the great oil fields of the Tampico-Veracruz area, mostly offshore, were discovered. Unlike Saudi Arabia, Mexico's oil has not done much to transform the country. The government-owned oil industry has been ineffective in using oil wealth for general social improvement. True, it built the tallest building in Mexico City, the Pemex building, which houses the Mexican National Oil Company, Petróleos Mexicanos. However, Pemex is not run efficiently, and it is grossly overstaffed with more than 108,000 employees. This contrasts with ExxonMobil, which has five times the revenues, yet employs way fewer people. Pemex did bring local prosperity to some of the coastal communities where the oil fields are located. For the vast majority of Mexicans, the oil has had little effect except to keep the price of gasoline from becoming as high as it might be if Mexico did not have the oil resources. The oil revenues have not been used to raise the Mexican standard of living. Pemex provides the government with 40% of its revenues and pays 70% of the cost of running the national electric grid. Exactly where the rest of that tax revenue goes is uncertain. Pemex is Mexico's cash cow, and the state-run company pays over 60% of its revenues in taxes and royalties to the central government. Because of this heavy tax burden, Pemex has lost money for the past 5 years and has had to borrow by issuing bonds and using various other devices to keep it going. It now owns a staggering $42.5 billion. Pemex's debt is four times that of ExxonMobil. There is trouble ahead. And editor's note, this was written long before the crash of the prices in 2014-2015. The Canetrel oil field that supplies 62% of Mexico's total production has peaked and is in steep decline. Just to maintain Mexico's oil production, the government will have to invest as much as $100 billion in the coming decade. Taxes prevent Pemex from retaining enough of its earnings to finance needed expenditures. Francisco Rojas, who ran Pemex from 1987 to 1994, referred to Pemex's decaying infrastructure and lack of money for exploration, saying, quote, "We are looking at a time bomb," unquote. The Mexican government has recently announced it would leave more money in Pemex. It remains to be seen if they will keep this promise. An ironic result of the big Pemex oil discoveries may be that Mexico will wind up deeper in debt because of them. On the basis of Mexico's oil finds, foreign banks were persuaded to loan the large amounts of money, now totaling more than $100 billion. Where most of this money wound up is uncertain. What clearly remains is huge foreign debt. The value of the Mexican peso collapsed to about 2,500 to the dollar. Subsequently, it was replaced by a new peso. The new denomination collapsed, reaching an all-time low against the U.S. dollar in February 1995. The resulting economic crisis led the Mexican Treasury to issue another new peso. By borrowing against their oil reserves, Mexico's oil riches, in effect, have been spent before the oil is pumped. There is also some question as to whether or not the oil reserves actually are as large as the government claims for collateral on their debt. Nauru, phosphate. This little Pacific Island nation once had, past tense, a single but very rich mineral deposit, phosphate. It also appears to be the nation that had the mineral resource with the shortest economic lifespan. By 2000, all its phosphate was mined. The challenge, while phosphate income was available, was to make investments which would continue to support the population. To manage these investments, the country formed the Nauru Phosphate Royalty Trust. One such investment is Nauru House, the 52-story tallest office building in Melbourne, Australia. The building is big enough to accommodate the entire population of Nauru, about 4,000 citizens, if they chose to convert it into a hotel. Nauru also issues very colorful postage stamps which attract collectors. But how significant and sustainable that income will be is highly questionable. Recently, Nauru sued the Australian government, claiming Australia had not paid as much as it should have for the phosphate. Nigeria, oil. This is the largest African nation in terms of population, with 162 million people and a growth rate projected to increase its population to 237 million by 2025. and 437 million by 2050. Nigeria is now a major oil producer and a member of OPEC. When Arab nations cut off oil supplies to the United States in 1970, it was fortunate that Nigeria at that time, rather than Saudi Arabia, was the principal foreign supplier of U.S. oil from the Eastern Hemisphere. Nigeria had an oil surplus to make up in part for the oil that the Arabs did not supply. There was a shortage, but Nigeria continued to make regular oil shipments to the United States, without which the U.S. situation would have been much, much worse. When President Shagari, who was from the northern part of the country, came to power in 1979, he had barely enough votes from the other regions in Nigeria to win the office. In order to create a political consensus for his regime, he tried to spread the oil bonanza money throughout the country in the form of large public works projects. The effects of these projects was that the percentage of the Nigerian population living on farms dropped from 85% to 65% as people moved to the cities. They also changed their tastes from homegrown millet, yams, cassava, and sorghum to imported foods, so that some advantages of the oil income for providing foreign exchange were lost simply to fill the new demand to buy foreign foods. Also, international salesmen, seeing large amounts of oil money, arrived on the scene and sold projects to Nigeria that, in some cases, were not well suited to the economy, and some have been outright economic disasters. Nigeria has made some effort to invest its petroleum revenues in enterprises for the long-range national good. One example was the completion of a world-class fertilizer complex at On River State near Port Harcourt. The $800 million project serves domestic as well as export markets. For overcropped, nutrient-depleted soils in many parts of Nigeria, this fertilizer will be most useful. But the problem with this project in the long term is that the feedstock for the plant is natural gas, from which the ammonia fertilizer is made. So it is still dependent on petroleum and cannot last beyond the life of Nigerian petroleum. However, the project, which now gets its gas from the Alakuri field around 9 miles away, will save Nigeria about $100 million a year in fertilizer imports. This is a substantial help in the near future and for a number of years to come. But if agriculture and population expand on this non-renewable resource, what is the ultimate outcome? Can the much larger population continue to be supported after the petroleum is gone? Unfortunately, overall, Nigeria has not managed its petroleum wealth carefully. In 1995, the Wall Street Journal reported, quote, "And Nigeria, after squandering its petrodollars, is now bankrupt. It needs $20 billion of oil company investment to keep its industry running," the World Bank estimates. "Production from its huge fields discovered in the 1960s is now slacking," unquote. The political economy of Nigeria remains one of gross indebtedness, inefficiencies, and mismanagement. An irreplaceable resource, which could have done much more for the country, is being largely squandered. Nigeria remains beset with problems. It is rated as one of the most corrupt regimes in the world. Lack of civil control has reached the point that Shell Oil Company says it may not be able to continue operations there because of the ongoing sabotage of equipment. With corruption, lack of civil order, growing religion-based terrorism, a fast-growing population, already the largest of any African nation, the future of Nigeria is dim indeed. That jihadist terror organization, Boko Haram, whose name translates from the Hausa language to Western education is sacrilege, and which began attacking Christian targets in 2010, is only the latest threat to Nigeria's fragile stability. Oil revenues, surely, have not been used as wisely as they might have. Nigeria has about 37 billion barrels of oil reserves, and if civil order can be maintained, there are fair prospects for additional discoveries. But Nigerians themselves lack the ability to conduct oil operations, so foreign technology and investments are required. The country's production is expected to peak right around now. Norway. This is a land of mountains, beautiful fjords, and lots of rock. About 2% of Norway's land is arable. There's not a drop of oil in Norway's largely igneous rock terrain. Norway has always had to live in considerable part from the sea. It continues to do so thanks to oil and gas discovered in 1969 by Phillips Petroleum in the Norwegian sector of the North Sea. Today, almost half of Norwegian government revenues are derived from petroleum. Norway is currently one of the world's largest oil exporters, with a small population and a limited domestic demand for the large amount of oil that it produces. How have its oil revenues been spent? Norway has used a lot of it to keep unemployment low. Billions of dollars of petroleum revenues have been poured into what turned out to be money-losing projects in agriculture, iron mining, smelters, and fishing in order to keep the people employed. This is a temporary fix and does not build a sound economic base for the long term. Norway did change some of its priorities for spending its oil money and has been putting more into research. Halvard Bach, Minister of Cultural and Scientific Affairs, said, quote, "Our main objective is to expand the possibilities of the Norwegian economy and to give it more feet to stand on so that it does not have to rely on oil and oil-related industries," unquote. An example of this is the decision to pursue genetic engineering and apply it to one of Norway's new and rapidly growing enterprises, aquaculture. Money is being invested to study the Norwegian fjords as places to raise a variety of fish, such as halibut, salmon, and cod. Perhaps by genetic engineering, some fast-growing fish species can be adapted especially to fjord ecology. Roads and bridges have been built, and these are the best in Scandinavia. However, much of the money seems to have been spent subsidizing a generous social welfare system. Healthcare and higher education are free, and farmers enjoy very high crop subsidies. Norway's oil reserves are about 5.3 billion barrels. Production peaked in 2001 and is now in decline. The resulting decline in oil revenue will be a problem, but not so much as in countries with a high population growth rate. Norway's population of 5.1 million has a very low growth rate of about 0.4% annually, bringing its projected expected population to 5.6 million in 2025 and 6.6 million by 2050. Looking toward that future, Norway has set up a petroleum fund with various investments now totaling nearly $200 billion. In 2005, a new government was elected, pledging to spend more of the oil wealth on social programs. How much of this means a change in direction in spending is not yet clear. Norway already has the most comprehensive welfare program in Europe. Argentina. This country has been a long-time modest oil producer, with estimated reserves in 2010 of 2.5 billion barrels. Revenues have been used chiefly for current government expenses, with some going into private pockets, a common fate of oil revenues throughout Latin America. Brazil. Brazil's oil reserves are now about 14.2 billion barrels, mostly located offshore in the Campos and Santos basins. Brazil is a relative newcomer in the oil business. With the largest population and economy in South America, Brazil has been chronically short of transport fuels, so the oil which it produces goes to supply domestic demand. If recent discovery continues, Brazil may soon be an oil exporter. Currently, its modest oil and iron ore and bauxite revenues have been used to support various government programs and to improve the transport infrastructure of that largest of all South American countries. Venezuela. This country is by far the largest oil producer in South America, with much of its conventional oil in two areas, the Lake Macabro Basin on the northwest coast and in southeast Venezuela in the official Oficina region. A very heavy oil deposit is also known and being produced in modest amounts in the Orinoco River Basin of southeastern Venezuela. Venezuela has had a fairly turbulent political history right up to the present time. Its oil fields were nationalized many years ago. Given a huge importance of oil to Venezuela, the Oil Workers Union is a strong element on the political scene, even going on strike occasionally against the government oil company, PSVDA, for which they work. During their most recent strike, President Hugo Chavez fired many of the workers. In doing so, he lost some of the much-needed oil field expertise. Venezuela has a rapidly growing population, which has benefited from oil in modest ways through schools, roads, and other public facilities. Some money has been used to subsidize the price of gasoline and the cost of public transportation. Various social welfare programs have been established in many parts of the country in the form of subsidized food markets that help to support the Chavez regime politically. With a current population of 29 million, expected to increase to 35 million by 2025 and 41 million by 2050, oil revenues are urgently needed simply to provide for basic education, the infrastructure of safe water, sanitation, and medical facilities, and provide housing for the large segment of the population that is poor. Venezuela has made one substantial long-term investment. The government-run oil company established refineries and built gasoline service stations in the United States, which is its main market for exported oil. Not many people in the United States know that Citgo stations are Venezuela-owned. In spite of Venezuela's rapid population growth and associated social needs, President Hugo Chavez purchased 7 Russian MIGs and a fleet of Russian attack helicopters in 2004. In 2005, he bought 100,000 Russian AK-47 rifles. Flush with the money from high oil prices, President Chavez spent over $4 billion, the equivalent, in 2005 and 2006, buying additional military equipment, making Venezuela the most heavily armed country in Latin America. Since 2005, Venezuela has signed contracts with Russia for 24 Sukhoi fighter jets, 50 transport and attack helicopters, and 100,000 or more assault rifles. Venezuela also has plans to open Latin America's first Kalashnikov factory to produce rifles in the city of Maracay. Venezuela is hardly threatened by its neighbors. If it was, it seemed certain that the United States, with a considerable interest in protecting Venezuela as a source of oil, which it very much needs, would intervene on Venezuela's behalf. Likewise, if Venezuela embarked on conquest of its neighbors, the United States would be likely to intervene in such an action. House of 7 MIGs and a fleet of attack helicopters contribute to Venezuela's well-being is not apparent. These purchases instead may be related to the recent civil uprising against Chavez and the strike by the oil workers against his government, during which Chavez was briefly out and then back into office. The arms purchases may be to protect the existing government. Since revolutions are one of the recurring features of this South American history, having the support of the military has generally been a good idea for those in power. The overall view. We have seen one mineral-dependent country, Nauru, face the fact that its one and only mineral resource and basic source of income is completely gone. In contrast, Saudi Arabia has petroleum that will last for many decades. But all of the oil-rich countries have built their economies on a depletable resource. Some have invested portions of their income wisely for the future. These are mainly the small countries, or the countries with small populations, and a large resource, such as Kuwait. They have had a surplus of cash from their oil income, which they could invest either within their own countries or abroad. Other countries, generally with larger populations, have used their mineral income to meet current expenses, and they have not been able to put away significant investment money for the future. Brazil is one such country. In other countries, graft and corruption have siphoned off substantial oil income for the benefit of a few. Nigeria has the dubious distinction of being one of those countries. The mineral and oil wealth of a number of countries, some undeveloped, has disappeared into Swiss bank accounts and in other ways gone into relatively few pockets rather than being used for the general good. Thus, the legacy of how these mineral monies are used will run varied courses. Some run their course as soon as they are received. They are spent immediately in one fashion or another for current expenses or projects of varying political or social merit. But mineral income that is invested wisely by governments today will markedly influence the lives of their citizens for the better, probably for many generations to come. In retrospect, such leaders will be remembered and honored for their foresight and integrity. One thing is clear. Governments spend far too much money on armaments. Too little money is spent looking toward the future. The one-time window of opportunity for wise use of the money from mineral riches slowly closes as income declines from depleting resources. Individuals seem to do it better. In contrast to governments that get money from taxes on oil and other minerals and buy military hardware consisting of billions of dollars, some individuals who have gained from the mineral bonanzas have benefited the future by using their money in a variety of long-term constructive ways. On a much smaller scale than government expenditures for arms, but with a far lasting, greater lasting and positive effect, these people have left legacies of great value. By forming universities, museums, scholarships, research foundations, medical facilities, libraries, and other institutions, these gifts will do much more for future generations than fighter planes, missiles, tanks, submarines, and assault rifles. Such carefully administered and specifically designated uses of mineral riches are likely to be the most efficient employment of these funds, rather than those subject to the political hazards of being dispersed through governmental agencies where graft and corruption in many places are rampant in many places. We all benefit. Most people who benefit from these mineral legacies don't know they are benefiting, nor do they know the sources from whence their benefits come. Those who receive named bequests, such as the Guggenheim and Rhodes grants, may know the source. Most of us have had our lives touched in one way by mineral-endowed legacies, but how many visiting Grand Teton National Park or Acadia National Park know that portions of these parks were donated by the Rockefeller Foundation? Those sources of bequests to medical research facilities are often not apparent to those who benefit. Hopefully, more of the Earth's resource wealth will be invested for long-term good. There are many opportunities to do this, and many programs and projects are ongoing. Both oil and mining companies contribute to educational institutions. ExxonMobil recently gave $100 million to Stanford University for unrestricted basic environmental research. One particular need for wise investment of current income, derived from mineral development and indeed from general governmental tax revenues, is to prepare for a time when we no longer have the use of non-renewable earth-derived energy and mineral resources. As we enter a new and much different world, new technologies to support that future need more support now than they now receive. These include everything from developing renewable energy resources to learning how to crop land while retaining its fertility. Greater government and private funds must be directed toward these future needs. The future is built on what is done today. Money from minerals, carefully invested now by governments or individuals, can help many people in the future. And then he concludes with a quote from an unknown author. We have all drunk from wells that others have dug.